You're listening to EPN, the E-Podcast Network.
This is Eric Dye, and once again, welcome to Enterprise Radio, your EPN channel for exclusive interviews with entrepreneurs, small business owners, and some of the world's top executives who are having great success. Today, we're speaking with Dr. Brent Wilson, the founder of the Child Welfare Collaborative, a nonprofit dedicated to bringing awareness to the misuse and over-medication of children in today's foster care system. The CWC assists state and nonprofit agencies to assure there is appropriate oversight of psychotropic medications for foster children. Dr. Wilson, a pleasure to have you with us today on the program.
Thank you, Eric.
And you're most welcome. Our pleasure. So for starters, tell us about starting the Child Welfare Collaborative Organization and what does the organization do?
Well, we started back in 2011 after I had an opportunity in Georgia to review cases in the foster care system brought to my attention by child attorneys. These were kids that had lived in the system for maybe a decade or more. They were on a number of psychotropic medications, sometimes more than what was indicated for their diagnosis. And we, as a group of physicians and attorneys, we reviewed those cases and provided some feedback back to the state that resulted ultimately in these children being reassessed, reevaluated, and in a sense shined a light on the issue of what is more of a systemic problem, that kids that become institutionalized, sometimes their behaviors are treated with medications rather than seen as a manifestation of the trauma they've experienced during their early lives.
Now, Dr. Wilson, why did you decide to start the collaborative, and was there a particular moment that made you want to get involved and start your own nonprofit?
You know, the Georgia Administrative Office of the Courts gave us a call probably a year before we started the nonprofit and told us about a couple of cases of individuals who were in a group home, were clearly either over-sedated, had some sort of other side effect from a medication they were on. And after that year and after reviewing those cases, I think we decided that we could do that in locations other than just Georgia. So we moved to Alabama and South Carolina and did similar work, and had a really rewarding experience in South Carolina, where we were able to design an oversight system for the entire state of foster kids, so that every medication that was prescribed to a foster kid in one of the highly restrictive institutions was reviewed not only by me, but also by senior level counselors in the regions, so that every pill that went in every kid's mouth in one of those locked institutions got a review by someone who had knowledge of medications. So I think that, you know, we got our start in Georgia, and we got our start because a lawyer called and said, "I'm worried about these two kids." But after reviewing hundreds of cases, I think that myself and some other doctors I worked with just found a passion for the advocacy work. And it takes a child psychiatrist within the system to do some education, because what we found is that case managers really felt incapable of addressing a physician and saying, "We're not going to consent to that medication." And so they just needed someone to sort of back them up, another state level employee or contractor, to say, you know, we understand that our child's having some difficulty in this group home or in this institution. At this point, we're not ready to consent to a fourth or fifth or sixth psychotropic medication for our child.
And certainly appreciate what you're doing, and I'm sure there are many that feel the same. How do you motivate other organizations and people to collaborate with you and the Child Welfare Collaborative?
Well, I think it's pretty easy. We've transitioned from doing some of the advocacy work at the state level. The federal government came out right around the time we started, maybe 6 months later, and we were involved in a national conference that brought leaders all 50 states, from Medicaid, social services, and the behavioral health departments to D.C. to address the over-medication issue. So all states now are forced to have some sort of oversight mechanism for over-medication. We've shifted our focus a little bit to providing funds to organizations that support skill building, among kids in their late teenage and early 20s as they try and transition out of the foster care system. So at this point, you know, our motivation, or the way we motivate people, albeit with money, is also trying to educate them about the issue. So the issue we focus on now, in addition to medications, we certainly would still advocate for the appropriate medication of kids in the foster care system, juvenile justice system, homeless children, other kids that may have behavioral issues. We try to educate them that these children are less likely to graduate from high school, certainly about, you know, maybe 2% on average graduate from college. Many of them wind up in jail. Many of them wind up with an early pregnancy. Many of them wind up with mental health issues. And so I think that we found some professions that are willing to train kids that are exiting the system so they have a skill. So even if they wind up pregnant, even if they wind up in jail, even if they don't wind up with a high school diploma, GED, or college diploma, they have a skill that they're able to use in the marketplace that allows them to live independently, earn money, and feel like that they have some sort of purpose, you know, outside the foster care system. These kids often have told many of us that they feel, you know, relatively rejected or useless. And so giving them a purpose in the world, even if it's not an education, even if they can't stay out of the legal system, we try and motivate other professionals to help us educate these kids and give them some sort of skill that would allow them to live independently. So we have funded restaurants primarily to teach them the food service industry, and that model exists across the nation. And so once you educate restaurant industry professionals about these other programs, it's a relatively easy sell, and we pay for those restaurant professionals' time to educate kids on the front of house and back of house, you know, how to, anywhere from setting a table, making a meal, cleaning up, dishwashing, anything that would potentially give them employment despite whatever other challenges they have, whether it's lack of education, whether they have some sort of criminal record, whether they have child care responsibilities early in life. Our goal at this point is not only to advocate for them from a mental health standpoint, but also to fund organizations that will help us educate these individuals.
Terrific information. Thanks so much. Now, how or what is a trend that excites you right now?
Well, I think like I was talking about, you know, 5 to 10 years ago, the federal government really jumped on board on the mental health side and said, you know, we agree that foster kids are being over-medicated, and albeit a financial incentive at times to reduce the pharmacy cost from the Medicaid side, because all foster children have Medicaid, I think there's a secondary benefit when it comes to shining a light on an issue. And so when you focus on the issue of medication, people all of a sudden become excited about what other mental health services are not being provided. So when you save money on the medication side, what can you do with that savings? I think there has been a renewed interest also in preservation efforts, so keeping kids at home, prevention efforts, so trying to prevent the removal of children. And I think all of that has happened because although people don't want to think about foster care as a business, the number of foster kids goes down when there's a recession and goes up when the economy is healthy. And so I think the exciting thing now is that although the foster care numbers are going the wrong way, per se, you know, we're removing more kids from the home, it helps Congress, legislators, policymakers focus on the trends that are going in the wrong direction and focus their funds on preservation of the home environment and also prevention of the removal.
Today, we're joined by Dr. Brent Wilson, the founder of the Child Welfare Collaborative, a nonprofit dedicated to bringing awareness to the misuse and over-medication of children in today's foster care system here on Enterprise Radio, a part of EPN, the Enterprise Podcast Network. Now, what is one habit that makes you a successful entrepreneur and leader?
Oh, goodness. You know, starting from day one, I got my start, obviously, you know, going through residency and going through a child fellowship and a chief residency at Emory. I really got exposed to the public sector. And once I started to learn the business of mental health care, how those services are paid for, I think we made our business initially by not turning down any opportunity. There are some very challenging children. There are some what some people would call million-dollar children, you know, spend $1 million on their mental health care and their housing while they're in the foster care system. And regardless of how challenging a child was, whether they were in jail, whether they were in a highly restrictive institution, there was nothing we shied away from when it came to an opportunity to grow our business. So, you know, the kids that no one else felt they could handle, the kids that people felt were extremely violent, the kids that had been moved to 40, 50, or 60 placements during their foster care tenure, we gladly took those cases and dived into those cases. And I think we found that the system was grateful for some sort of consultation beyond that they were able to get previously. So typically these kids would bounce around to placements, therefore bounce around to schools, bounce around to doctors, and would not have someone that stayed with them longitudinally. And I think what we offered is that regardless of where the child was placed, we would continue to provide some sort of consultation on not only their mental health care, not only their medications, but from a social standpoint, what would be best for them and allow them to succeed in the long run. Because we understood that these children may not get adopted. And we understood that the state may have to provide for them up until 18, or if they chose to stay in the foster care system until 21, until they were 21. So I think that the opportunity that we took advantage of is that there are just some children that are, for lack of a better way of saying it, very costly from a human resources standpoint. And so they're just starving for somebody to help them manage the day-to-day medication, day-to-day mental health, day-to-day placement issues. And I think we just made ourselves available, 24/7, whatever questions you have. And care if you were an adoptive parent, a foster parent, a case manager, and an administrator, you know, we would take that call and, you know, help provide you guidance. We'd be, you know, involved in any case planning meetings, whatever teleconferences we could be involved in, and making referrals to any mental health providers that we thought provided the highest quality mental health services as well.
Good stuff there. Thanks for that. Now, how does the future look for the Child Welfare Collaborative in from your perspective in terms of growth and bringing change to the over-medication of children in the foster care system?
You know, I think it's an exciting time. I always am a little skeptical when you start to fear a monopoly situation, but I think we're looking at a time where, just like what happened with the airlines, you're seeing healthcare companies merge. And so you've seen some large healthcare companies decide that they want to get together on insuring their members, but also providing pharmacy benefits. You also have a healthcare initiative that's come about with Amazon, Berkshire Hathaway, that's been in the news recently. And I think that as you get providers on the private side, like Amazon, CVS, Aetna, Cigna, any of the large healthcare providers that want to trim costs and provide appropriate care, I think there's a huge opportunity for us to contribute to those efforts, but also talk about what makes the most sense from a mental health care package, albeit medications or other ancillary services. I think the other growth opportunity for us, given that the economy, again, is doing relatively well, is we work in local communities with small business owners that are willing to take funds to pay for their staff's time to do nothing but dedicate to teaching former foster youth, current foster youth, foster kids that might be in the juvenile justice environment and be on probation. There are plenty of models for prison release programs, but there aren't as many models for, let's say, foster care release when you turn 18 and you want to get out of the system. So I think the areas of growth, number one, are partnering with large private organizations, governmental organizations that are trying to make healthcare decisions for kids' mental health. And then secondly, funding small businesses that are willing to teach children how to have a skill that regardless of their education and regardless of their criminal record, they can use for the rest of their lives to support themselves independently.
Well, you're certainly doing a fabulous job in the space. We can't thank you enough for what you do and for joining us here today as well. One last question before you go. Do you have any advice for our listeners who literally are tuning in from all over the world looking to start a new organization or a company? What's your thoughts there?
I think kids are always an easy space to capture not only funds, but people's attention. So, you know, when I think about the largest expenditure of healthcare dollars, I think about cancer. And child cancer is a lot easier if you think about the St. Jude's of the world. It's a lot easier to get people to think about wanting to cure or help childhood cancer than it is to help cancers that affect people later in life. I think the same is true with mental health. I think if you are passionate about helping kids improve their mental health, you can see the benefit as they go into their adult years. I would say to starting locally with local foster care organizations that recruit foster parents is the easiest way to learn the business of the red tape that, you know, goes from removing the child, placing the child in a foster home, group home, or institution, and then trying to get the child adopted. And once you understand that system, then you can decide where you fit best in that market. But no different from any other human being in the United States that we have to take care of, once a child is removed from their home, they need total care. You know, they need room and board, but they also need the emotional, mental support that any other child would get in their traditional birth home. And so I think there are several opportunities to do that. Again, you can volunteer or work for a foster care organization that recruits foster parents. You can become a CASA, which is a court-appointed special advocate. The CASA programs, basically, you're a volunteer and you go to court with the child and you represent them and you represent what you think is their best interest. It's another voluntary program, so you would form a relationship with that one child. You would get to know them. You'd get to know their time in foster care and their struggles in foster care. And I think, thirdly, I think if people were willing to take a job in an institution, a group home, a psychiatric residential treatment facility, or any other institution that cares for foster kids, I think learning the struggles that the system has and finding the holes in the system. And again, one of the holes that we've found is the system doesn't necessarily prepare children well to live independently. So when it comes to financial literacy, when it comes to job training, when it comes to having your own apartment, having your own car, getting your own job, how to dress for the interview, all of those basic life skills are not well provided for in the foster care system, especially those that are institutionalized. So expecting someone who's lived in an institution for most of their life to leave the institution, be able to get a job, get an apartment, cook for themselves, do their own laundry, drive themselves, is somewhat of an insurmountable task without social support. And a lot of the data says that what these children need most is social support. They don't have a lot of friends, brothers, cousins, uncles, aunts, mothers, fathers to rely upon. And so I think if you're looking to start a business in this sphere, I think you have to learn the struggles first and then figure out where you fit in best. And so visiting group homes, working within them, becoming a foster parent, even if you just provide respite foster care once or twice a month for a family that already has a foster kid, I think learning the business first, learning the challenges, figuring out where you fit in, there's an enormous opportunity to serve kids. I mean, we have more than 400,000 foster kids in this nation. And we're a nation that still adopts, you know, kids from international locations. So I think learning, you know, in your local area, even though you may not know of any parents that have foster kids, you may not know of any group homes, you could easily find an organization that does this work. And I think volunteering or working for that organization would help you learn where the holes are and, you know, what could ultimately benefit kids coming out of the system.
Dr. Wilson, certainly appreciate that parting advice, most helpful, and again, for all the information and introducing what you're doing through Child Welfare Collaborative. Where can listeners get all the details online and be in touch accordingly?
At this point, you know, we for a number of years, for our first 5 years, we did have a strong internet presence. At this point, you know, we're again working in local communities, funding local organizations. So I think passing along my name, my email address, my telephone number, you know, we take calls all the time from local organizations. But I think we're looking to build into a regional or national presence. We've been able to do that on the medication side, and what we'd like to do is partner with some other organizations, you know, that do this work outside of the Delmarva area, the Baltimore, D.C., Virginia area, and also the Atlanta, Georgia area. So I think passing along my, you know, individual contact information would be most helpful.
Totally understand where you're coming from. Again, Dr. Wilson, all the best, and thanks so much for joining us here today on EPN. Much appreciated.
Well, thank you so much for your time. My pleasure as well.
We have been speaking with Dr. Brent Wilson, the founder of the Child Welfare Collaborative, a nonprofit dedicated to bringing awareness to the misuse and overmedication of children in today's foster care system. The CWC assists state and nonprofit agencies to assure there is appropriate oversight of psychotropic medications for foster children. And for further details, pay attention to the show notes of this broadcast. And again, this is Eric Dye, and you've been listening to Enterprise Radio, a part of EPN, the Enterprise Podcast Network. Tune in to our live location as we are streaming live 24/7 around the world at enterprisepodcastnetwork.com/live. You can also find our live stream on iTunes Radio and TuneIn Radio, as well as the TuneIn Radio app for your listening convenience. And as always, we thank you for your support and for tuning in.
This is the ePodcast Network.